The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Sometimes you get a chance to really sense what it means to feel it. You really feel it. And you try to hang on to that. I read this amazing story. It was a parishioner in a church who, you know, he had a small church. And they had a storm. And Sunday morning, before they were supposed to have their big service, there was a terrible storm that apparently knocked or dislodged some stones from the roof of this church building and blew a hole in the wall of the church. He's all set for a big service Sunday morning. This is the big highlight. They have a monthly get-together for the whole community. Everybody's coming, and there's a big hole in his church wall. And he's got a few hours. He doesn't know what to do. Go try to find someone to fix it, even if you could find someone on a Sunday morning to get them to come on time. And even if they could get there on time, who has the money to pay for such things? He doesn't know what to do. And he's promised a fellow parishioner, somebody, that he's going to show up at a different service, sort of an hour before his own service. And he goes, you know, whatever, sort of to the outskirts of the village to try to find this particular neighborhood. And he goes to visit this, you know, person from his parish, and he visits their, you know, fellow church, and he goes to the service, and he speaks, and everything is good, and he comes out, and he sees there's one of these, like, country fairs. And he notices in the country fair that they're selling different items, and he sees a beautiful tablecloth. They're selling a beautiful sort of latticed tablecloth for $6. And the tablecloth just catches his eye because it's so beautiful. It's got such intricate work, and he can't believe it's only $6. And he sees that, you know, they're auctioning it off, and the fellows who are running this particular booth are holding up this tablecloth. And he looks at the tablecloth, and he starts to realize that it's just about the right size. So an idea grabs him, and he figures, what the heck, he's got nothing to lose. And he pays $6, and he buys the tablecloth. And he gets back to his church, and he's got like 10 minutes before the service. And you can imagine there's a big gaping hole. You can imagine you show up and it's a nice evening and there's a big hole here out to the seat. Yeah, that's uncomfortable. And what he does is he hangs this huge, beautiful tablecloth right over the wall, and sure enough, it exactly fits over this wall. Great. It's a summer day. Nobody will notice. The wise are great. Everybody shows up and people are drawn to this beautiful tablecloth and they notice. They think it's a new piece of artwork. You know, they don't see the hole behind it. Great. And he notices that there's one woman who's sitting in the audience. And you could tell Nebuch, you know, she seems to be a little down on her luck. You could tell sometimes a person's clothes are a little bit worn through. They don't have the latest fashion. When a person has a tough time, their body reflects their energy. She was a little stooped. Sometimes a person looks like they're carrying the weight of the world. And she walks over, and, you know, and he walks over to her and he says, you know, is everything okay? You look like you're having a tough time, right? And she says, you know, I was noticing your beautiful tablecloth. Says, you know, I once had a tablecloth like that. In fact, it looks a lot like that. Before the war, I lived in Vienna, and I had a big family. And my husband actually gave me this beautiful tablecloth. He actually embroidered my initials in the corner of the tablecloth. And I was just thinking, looking at this tablecloth, all the memories that come back. And she walks over, and she's looking at the tablecloth, and all of a sudden she lets out a gasp. Because there in the corner of the tablecloth, true story, there in the corner of the tablecloth are her initials. And she can't believe it. And the two of them start talking about this. And of course, the priest, he figures, you know, $6. I mean, you know, he explains to her why he bought it and how he put it up there. And it was fate, that it was meant to be, that she should find this. And he wants to give it back to her. And she says, no, what would I do with such a tablecloth? You know, I've had a tough time. I have no family, really. I have a small place. And I have a very small table. The tablecloth won't even fit on that. I'm happy that it's doing good and that people are seeing that and it's beautiful. So she says, no, you can keep it. But, you know, it's comforting to know that that thing's up here. And she leaves. And he's contemplating this. And people come over to him all day and they're complimenting him about this tablecloth. And so beautiful on the wall. And it just fits just right. And it's magnificent. And so he decides to leave it up there. And the next morning they have, like, I guess their weekday service, right? And people are filtering in and out. And he sees that there's a fellow who's staring at the tablecloth. And he looks like he's having some kind of a spiritual experience. And, you know, sometimes people walk in out of the blue and they have strange spiritual experiences. You get a little nervous. So I guess he's used to those kinds of characters sometimes coming in. So he walks over to this old fellow and he says, you know, is everything okay? And the old fellow says, well, you know, I was just looking at that tablecloth. And I remember I once gave my wife such a beautiful tablecloth. before the war. I lived in Vienna. And the priest's mouth pops open and he's telling a story. He says, I even embroidered her initials in the corner of the tablecloth, right? And the priest puts his arm around him and the guy thinks, you know, it's a nice story, but you know, you don't have to get all cozy, right? And he takes him over to the tablecloth and he says, are these your wife's initials? And the man's jaw falls open. He says, how did this get here? How could this be here? This was lost in Vienna. The priest says, I have no idea, but I think you should sit down. And he sits him down and he tells him about the woman who had been there the day before. And of course, he hadn't thought to take her address. But she had actually been in town and she was mentioning that she had been in town to apply for a job which she didn't get in daycare. And they were able to find the family where she got the job. And through this tablecloth, this priest was able to reunite this couple that had been 15 years separated since the war. Because of a tablecloth. And I'm reading this article that this fellow wrote, and it's actually reprinted in a couple of books, about the feeling that he had when he witnessed this couple get back together. I once went to, you know, every year, every 5 years, depending, there's a conference in Yerushalayim for survivors. Anybody ever been to one of them? Amazing. Yeah? And they have a conference for survivors and for survivors' children. And there's an organization called Amcha, and they invite people. And I once spoke at one of these conferences. And, you know, there are very few experiences that you have where you're more in awe at the inadequacy of your ability to speak about anything, as when you're sitting with an audience full of Holocaust survivors and their children trying to express anything. And this is about 8 years ago. I actually got to witness the reunification of a brother and sister who had been lost to each other since the war. They're just moments that you experience, and you can't repeat them. You can't describe them. You can't explain them. And you want to grab them. And I guess the question is, how do you do that? How do you grab that feeling? What is that feeling? And what is it that we're looking for? And by way of sort of background explanation, it seems to me that the theme of all the discussions that we're having and all the discussions that we ever have, how do I succeed in becoming a better person? How do I succeed in becoming a more ethical person? I mean, is that really what I'm trying after all to do in this world? How do I make the world a better place, really? And by the way, by way of background, although we're not necessarily going to get there tonight, but at the end, Gilly will announce I was finally good and gave him all the topics for the next month and a half. What does Judaism have to do with that? In becoming a better person and in grabbing onto that. And you know, there are a lot of different organizations that share different ideas. And people talk about whether God exists. And about whether I can prove that God exists. And whether I can know that God exists. And some of you may have heard me say before, this is one of the things that I love most about Israelite, even if you could prove, I don't personally believe you can prove that God exists. But even if you could prove that God existed, by the way, that doesn't mean that you can't know that God exists. There are many things we know that we can't prove. But even if you could prove that God exists, the question is God relevant? And ultimately the question is, how do I develop a relationship with God? How do I know that God exists? And even if I could know that God exists with absolute certainty, would that be a good thing? Are there things in this world that I don't really want to know? Do I lose something by absolutely knowing? And by the way, even if I could know, you know, I know with absolute certainty that Laurent is wearing a blue sweatshirt. It's not really meaningful to me. Maybe it's meaningful to his collar, but it's not meaningful to me. It doesn't change my life. It doesn't blow my mind. It doesn't even change my day. You know, no offense. It's nice. I'm glad he's wearing a blue sweatshirt, not a green one, but it's nice. I want my relationship with Hashem, with God, to change everything. I'm willing to bet that if I went around this room, there would be a significant number of people in this room who are absolutely convinced that God exists. But does it change your life? And even if it does, how do I grab the feeling of a relationship? You know, I absolutely know with the certainty that one can only know in this world that my wife exists. And I'd like to believe that that changes my life on a regular basis. But it's a mistake to assume that you live all the way up on the mountain every day. You have those moments and you have those feelings. You know, I remember the feeling of standing under the chuppah. There are very few moments in your life that are as powerful as that moment. In fact, on the wedding video, afterwards, I didn't really notice this, to be honest. During the wedding, you're kind of in a blur. But afterwards, in the wedding video, right? Do you hear that little sound there, right? In the wedding video, So there's this moment where, I don't remember what's going on, I think Rabbi Riskin was talking, he did our wedding, and Dorit just kind of like phased out. She just went somewhere. I don't know where she went. But you're looking like the cameraman caught it. She's like this. She's like standing there like, you know, doing whatever a kala does that I have no idea. Under a wedding chuppah, I stopped trying to understand. And then she just like goes somewhere. And all of a sudden you see her go like this. Like, you know, like, where were you, right? And you have this moment where you really get it. You really understand what you're doing in this world. And where your whole journey makes sense. And this wellspring of feeling. And everyone in this room has had this experience once in their life. Maybe it isn't chuppah. Maybe it's like a Friday night dinner. Maybe it's that moment where you sang a hatikvah, or you stood on the Golan Heights, or you know what, you were in New York City on September 12th and you watched how people were behaving and you just got it. It just made sense to be in this world. You know, there are moments where you see things where you're just proud to be a member of the human race. And you catch that. How do you hang on to that? What is that? And what am I trying to experience? How can I feel that more often? And how do I get to know that with absolute certainty? Could I at least reach a point where that absolute certainty could stay with me? Because wouldn't it be great if I absolutely knew? There is, by definition, one or two or five or 10 people who are in this room who've met someone. And they're struggling with whether this is that relationship. And they just wish, if only I could know for sure. And maybe you can't know for sure. Or could you know for sure? Do you want to know for sure? Maybe all the fun is, if you don't know for sure, deciding whether to take a leap to see if you could ever know for sure. How do you know? And what do you do with that question? So I want you to understand that this is part of a larger issue that we are struggling with as a Jewish people. You know, Abraham Joshua Heschel described the Jewish people so powerful as a messenger that has forgotten his message. We've lost something. You know that song, "You've lost that love and feeling," right? That's the Jewish people today. We've lost something. What is it that we've lost? How do we recapture it? And how do we hang on to it? And ultimately, how do I develop a relationship with God? If I really want to feel that God is there. And by the way, this raises a very interesting question. Why do I want a relationship with God? Why do I want any of those relationships? You know, people talk about, can I know? Well, why do you want to know? I mean, let's say you never know. So you don't know. Let's say life is good. And you never figure it out. Is that so bad? Why is it that we feel this need, this struggle, to discover this ultimate truth? And even, by the way, in love. Why do I want to know? Why do I want to feel that I have found the person with whom I absolutely know and feel that loving feeling, whatever that is? Why do I even want that? I want you to know, practically, it makes no sense. It just makes trouble. It'd be so much easier if you could just look at it practically. We have a job to do. We want to create a company. We call the company the Friedman Family. So we need to find someone who, you know, can more or less figure out the things that I can't figure out, solve the problems I can't solve, and we'll create a corporation. And we'll call it the Friedman Corporation, Binny and Dorit Incorporated. You know? And it'll work. So what's the difference what I feel? Does anybody remember anything about how your great-great-grandparents feel? Most of us don't even know our great-great-grandparents. And if we did, we don't remember what they felt when they first met. Or what they felt when they lived. So what's the difference? What's the purpose to that feeling? What is it? Is it just some self-serving idea? Is it that it feels good? I want it, so it feels good? Well, if it's all about me, why would anything be so worthwhile if it's only about me? It has to be that if it's something that powerful, something that so many of us strive to find, it's got to be that it's more than just about me. And I want to understand what that is. And I want you to know, by the way, that there are two stages to this question. Two stages to my relationship with others, and two stages to my relationship with Hashem, with God. There is the first stage, and at the risk of being repetitive, just so we're all on the same page, which you could call knowing. Getting to know that God exists. That's one stage. There is the second stage, which is translating that knowledge into a feeling. And I want you to know, you meet many people who know, say they know, really do know, whatever knowledge is, but that doesn't mean that it sets them on fire. Is that just a gift? Is that just luck? Or is there some recipe? You know? I mean, you want to be in love. You want to be in love. Not just, by the way, in love with your husband or your wife or your date, but in love with everything. In love with your children. In love with what you do. In love with your world. In love with the people around you. In love with every day. In love with every minute. You want to be in love. That's what Rav Nachman talks about. Mitzvah gdola liot besimcha tamid. To be in a constant state of joy. And simcha is really a consequence of love. So you want to be there. But why do you want to be there? And how do you get there? And can you stay there? And I want you to know that I'm now going to contradict, which is more fun, everything we said last week. Because you can stay there. Now don't get me wrong, what I said last week is not incorrect. You grab those moments of inspiration and they disappear. And they're not meant to last. They're a gift and then you have to struggle and you have to find them. But having said all of that, that we spoke about last week, nonetheless, you can still grab onto this and you can stay there. And I want to understand how to do this. And what the purpose of this is. And what this means. And I hope, as Rat Hashem, in the little time that we have, that we can actually discover that this is one of the most essential issues today. And it is so appropriate, given everything that is going on right now in the world. So let's talk about these two concepts. I want you to know that one of the challenges here in New York, you know, when we give classes down in Florida, so it's a very different type of audience. Here, there's so many different backgrounds and so many different ranges and people who, you know, have been maybe more involved of recent with their Jewish identity and people less involved and people at this stage and people at that stage. People who've been around Israelite a lot, maybe people who are sitting here who've never, don't even know what Israelite is. They're not sure if they're getting themselves into a beer tasting contest, right? So, just to be sure that we're all on the same page, there are two ideas that everybody in this room needs to understand in order for us to get somewhere. And if you've heard this a few times, that's good, because you should review it, and it should be something you study every day, so today will be a day you get to it. So the first question is love. What is love? Okay? How do I know in anything? And I want you to know, it's not so complicated. It's really not so complicated. Because we make a mistake. We think that because we can't prove something, therefore we can't know it. And that's not true. It's not true in anything in life. Most of the things that we know, we can't prove. We know them nonetheless. Right? For example, imagine that you went out on a date and you got totally destroyed. Some person that you met that you thought could really be the right person just wrecked your life. Right? I mean, really dumped you. Right? So, Nebuch, you know, it's depressing. I could always tell when my guys in the yeshiva, when they would really, you know, I could tell when they had a great date, and I could tell when the dump came, you know, dump day. Usually, by the way, Thursday was dump day. That was usually, I don't know why it was, and so Friday morning when they would show up, I could tell whether Thursday night was dump night. Okay. And you could see somebody just met the love of his life because he's walking around, banging into poles, tripping over himself, whatever, looking at the Talmud and just fascinated by that word for hours, you know. So I realized it's not, you know, Bava Metzia, it's not the Talmudic tractate. And then you could always tell when Nebuch, you know, stick it in, turn it around, crush him, right? So you meet this girl, and she's incredible, and you're madly in love with her, and it's unbelievable, and then she crushes you, right? So Nebuch, you know, and you see these guys, they walk around like one of these Disney cartoon characters, you know, like droop along, you know, they're just like trudging through life, right? And then, you know, a month goes by, 2 months go by, 3 months go by, and then you meet someone else. And now you're on top of the world, because now you met this person, it's incredible. And it's unbelievable, and you're so excited. And then they dump you again. And they crush you. And not just like any crush. But like, I mean, like, I don't know, like you're in sergeant's course and you decided there's no point in going out because she's going back to America and you're in the Israeli army and it's 6,000 miles, so what's the point? But of course she's going back to Stern College where she can meet lots of guys and you're in the army, we have nothing to do but patrol with men, so you have lots of time on guard duty to think about her and you imagine what it would be like if when you got your sergeant stripes, she just shows up out of the blue and surprises you because you've been writing letters and she's going to surprise you and tell you she can't live without you. But of course on the day that you finish sergeant's course, you get a letter from her that she met this guy and oh, by the way, they're engaged, dump, crush, yes, this is a true story, right? Ah, right? So like they just like, and imagine that this happens to you. And it happens to you one too many times, and you decide that this whole concept of love is for the birds. It's for the birds. It's ridiculous, and you don't believe in love. There are people in this world, Nebuch, who don't believe in love. They don't believe love exists. What do you say to such a person? Is there anything you can say to prove to a person that they're being ridiculous? That of course love exists. You can talk to them about how you know people who love. Well, that's ridiculous. That's like telling someone who doesn't believe in God that you know people who do believe in God. That's ridiculous. You can tell them, listen, keep at it. You'll meet the right person. They say to you, I'm just not willing to be ripped to shreds again. I'd rather be happy, you know? I found my perfect soulmate. It's a box of ringdings. And you know, at the end of the day, I watch television. I got my ringdings. Life is good. Give me a break. Women are so complicated. Who needs it? Life is good, right? So you can never say anything to this person to prove to them that love exists. And they'd be right. You can't prove that love exists until, of course, they discover what love is, and then they know. And it's an interesting question. How do you arrive at that knowledge? How do you arrive at that knowledge? And again, at the risk of being repetitive, just because I want to be sure that we're all on the same page, and I want to share with you an idea that I was struggling with today. You know? But how do you know? Also, it's kind of like, I remember when my kids were learning how to ride a bike. And I was going to be super dad. I was determined to be super dad. And I got them out in the helmets and the pads. Mayan and Yonatan, they were both learning at the same time. And I got them all set up, and we're ready to roll. And you know, we're going down the hill, and I know how to ride a bike. When you put a kid on a bike, and you tell them how to ride a bike, it's not so complicated. Get on the bike, find your center of balance, hold onto the handlebars, push the wheels, and you can do it, right? So I'm there, and I'm holding the bike, and I'm running along. You can do it, you can do it, you can do it, you can do it, go! Right? No, come on, you can do it. We go up to the top of the hill. Come on, you can do it, you can do it, you can do it, you can do it, you can do it. You can do it, you can do it. Right? And we went through this for a week. And then I had to go to America on a trip. And I was away for a week. And I come home. And the two of them, after a week, you have to understand, I put a lot of effort because I was super dad, right? A week, I go to New York. I come back. The two of them are doing figure eights around the parking lot. And I go to Yonatan. He's 5 years old. I say, Yonatan, this is amazing. How did you learn how to ride a bike? He says, I don't know. I said, what do you mean you don't know? You were there. How did you learn how to ride a bike? Now, of course, he can't explain to me how he learned how to ride a bike, but of course he knows how to ride a bike. And he'll never forget how to ride a bike. So, of course, knowledge does not come from intellectual challenge. Knowledge comes from experience. He got on a bike, and he rode it, and he liked it, so he rode it again, and he liked it, so he rode it again. Putting aside for the moment why it is that when you get on a bike and you ride it and you fall on your face, and you get up again, you like it enough to do it again, that's another discussion. Eventually, you just get it. And I want you to know, we're looking for the complicated understanding. It's not so complicated. How do you know when you find the right person? Well, notwithstanding the fact that I just had a whole discussion with a few people as to whether or not you can ever really know before you get married, I think that's an illusion that's insidiously planted on us by Western society. In fact, I look back now and I can't imagine how I could ever think that I knew before I got married is beyond me. How could you possibly know? It's ridiculous, right? I'm just starting to come to terms with what I know now. But okay. So how do you know? Well, so you go on a date. You like the date, you go on another date. You like that date, go on another date. You go on enough dates one day, you know. In fact, I got news for you. You cannot know before you get married. Can't. How are you going to ever know that she's the right person to bring up your children? How are you going to know how she's going to struggle with you in life's difficult challenges? You can't know. So you decide to take a risk. You have enough good dates, and one day you just know. So the first stage is to love. Knowledge. And that comes through experience. If you want to know, if you want to share with someone why they're wrong and why love is not for the birds, they have to experience love. They can't experience love, by the way, because you push them into a crowded room. They have to experience love because they're willing to take a leap. And if you experience it, then you'll know. And I meet so many people who are convinced that they're going to show the world how beautiful Shabbos is. I don't know. I'm going to prove to you that Shabbos is incredible. I never understood that. I'm not looking to prove anything to anybody. I'm willing to share with anybody who wants to find out why I think Shabbat is beautiful. What you do with it is up to you. And I can talk to you about Shabbat till I'm blue in the face, and we can have a class about Shabbat, and we can talk about the beauty of Shabbat. But until you sit at a Shabbat table and see if someone blesses children, you'll never get it. And that's okay. So you go on a date, and one day, something happens. The same is true, interestingly enough, vis-a-vis our relationship with God. Because some people try intellectually to prove that God exists, when in reality, what I'm looking is to experience that God exists. You want to find out, you want to know whether God exists? Go on a date. Go on a date with God. You have a good date. Go on another date. I want you to know, I spent years trying to prove intellectually that the Torah is divine. It was my greatest challenge. I had such difficulty with this concept. I grew up in the traditional world. I went to yeshiva. And I realized eventually that everything is dependent on whether or not this book, comes from there or comes from here. Everything. I challenge you to come up with any major question within Jewish theology that isn't somehow related to this question. It's all back to this question. So I figured, okay, this is an important question. And I read through all the books, you know, Permission to Believe and Permission to Receive and the Chvais Nisht, you know, there are all so many books. 9 questions and 8 questions and the Rambam and Vuchim, not to put them in the same category, and all the, you know, Derech Hashem and Mesil Sishar, all over the place. And I can tell you, I can't tell you how many classes I gave. All the intellectual reasons for the proof that the Torah is divine, and none of them did one iota for me. Made absolutely no sense. They're all completely logical. And up here I can convince you and tell you and prove to you, and I could probably prove to you what I know you can't prove. Because it's all up here. It's like trying to prove to you that you should marry someone. It's ridiculous. So one day I put it all aside. I said, you know what, I'm just going to go on a date. Everybody seems to be having such a good time. I'm here breaking my head, trying to figure out what the book is divine. I'm not enjoying the study. So I'll just put it off and I'll go on a date. If I have a good time, I'll go on another date. So I went to yeshiva for a year. I went on a date. I had a good time. Went on another date. Had a good time. Went on another date. Went on so many dates, I became a rabbi. And one day, I just knew. So understand that the first stage is, can I reach a point of knowledge? And for a long time, I thought that that was it. That if I could actually reach that stage, if I could sit back and say, wow, I absolutely know that I married the right person. I absolutely know that I love my children. I absolutely know that Hashem exists in the world. I absolutely know that Hashem gives me everything every day. And that's great. And then one day I realized that wasn't enough. It wasn't enough. Maybe I'm greedy. It wasn't enough. And don't get me wrong. That's a very high thing. And just because you get there, it doesn't mean you stay there. It's a struggle. But there's something beyond. Because knowing that Hashem gives me this doesn't necessarily mean that I have a relationship with God. Just because I know I married the right person doesn't mean that I'm necessarily going to have a great marriage. And people make this mistake. You assume, you know, because the movie always ends there, because you've got to cover life in 2 hours and 15 minutes, right? Recently, Hollywood is making it 3 hours, and they're getting into trouble. But that's not where life ends, and that's not where the movie ends. That's where the movie starts. They walk off into the sunset, and then the next morning, who picks up the garbage? And how do you do the dishes? And what happens when the little three-year-old Nebuch doesn't make it into the toilet, right? They don't tell you that in Hollywood. So just because you find the right person, I'll leave you to translate this later, just because you find the right person does not necessarily mean that they remain the right person. And by the way, I want you to understand, we're not just talking about marriage here. That's just an allegory. We're talking about everything. You know, one of the most important things in life is discovering good friends. There are very few important things like good friends. You know? And if you can count one person in this world that you call a truly good friend, then you're way ahead of most people in the world. That's very high. And sometimes, you know, there are different types of friendships. Sometimes you meet a person and you click. You walk into your college class and they're in the same class, and the next thing you know, you can't believe it. Like, you must have met in a different life. Because it's just there. And you get that kind of friendship. And people think that you have to look for that friendship. And sometimes you get it given to you. But just because you find that kind of a friend, and you have that kind of a feeling, and it's that kind of an incredible, like, what a high, because I found this incredible friend in my life, who just gets it, and I can talk to them about anything, and they can talk to me about anything, and I want to give to them, and they want to give to me, and we can share, doesn't mean you hang on to that friendship. Because that friendship, like everything else that we spoke about last week, can wilt. That's the way of the world. Fresh bread grows stale, flowers wilt, the meat goes off, and friendships can die. How do I hang on to that? And so that's the second stage. The second stage is an interesting mistake. We were just talking about this, a few of us, before. We think, Hollywood thinks, that love is a noun. We think that love is something I have to find, and that I have to get it. And that one day I'll just be in love. I'll have discovered love. And of course, that raises an interesting question. What happens if you think you found love, and 2 years after you're married, you wake up one morning, you're just not in love. You don't love her. I want you to know, breaks your heart. I had a fellow who, two years ago, we were learning together a bit, and he said to me one day, he said, you know, I don't love my wife anymore. So I don't love my wife anymore. I'm married to her for, I don't know, whatever, however many years. They just celebrated their daughter's bat mitzvah. This is like now a year and a half ago. And I've got 3 kids. I don't love my wife. You know, we're talking about Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov. I don't love my wife. So So we put aside the Chumash, like what, you know. So what do you say to a person who doesn't love his wife anymore? So he wants to know what to do. Pardon? What? No. I'll tell you what happens. Very simple. You wake up one morning, you don't love your wife. I want you to know, by the way, so many people who are dating, this is their fear. You're going to wake up one morning, you realize you made a mistake, and you're not in love, right? You want to know what to do when you wake up one morning and you're not in love? And by the way, I will tell you something. This happens to every single marriage, unless you do something to prevent it. Don't assume you meet the right person and fireworks go off and you're in love and that's it. We're in love. We're there forever. It's not true. What do you do? And remember this. If you get nothing out of this whole year that we're learning Torah together, but the following 60 seconds yours is the earth. Remember this. When you wake up one morning and you're not in love, whether it's not in love with your spouse or not in love with your date or not in love with your parents or not in love with your children or not in love with your job or not in love with your life. So what do? You wake up one morning, you're not in love with your husband. You know what the answer is? Love him. So what do you mean love him? I just said I'm not in love with him. That's right, so love him. See, because we think love is a noun. Love is not a noun. Love is a verb. The process of love, the word love, ahava, comes from the root have to give. Love is about giving. Why is it that the greatest love in this world is the love parents have for their children? Why do we love our children so much? Because we give them everything. Because I give to my children so much. How could you not love someone that you give to them that much? What do? Your two kids come, right? And you know, when you get good at this, you can see it coming. You can see it with body language, you know? It usually starts with Adi. Adi is five, and it's with the hands, right? It starts like this. Adi is like opposite Yonatan. They're not sitting together. Yonatan is nine, just turned nine, right? So I know there's something coming. And I don't know what it is. And I can hear like the pitch voice. Why did you... No! Right? I don't know what it is. So I walk... So you can wait till they come to you. You know what Jonathan says? Slam me! Right? Whatever they say. So what do? So we have a rule in our family. We have a rule in our family. And I want you to know, Bezrat Hashem, you'll come down to Florida, or you'll come to Yerushalayim, you'll come to Efrat, you'll see my children. You can ask them this. You can ask them this 10 years from now. Say, so what do you have to do when you get into a fight with one of your brothers or sisters? And they'll tell you the same thing. The first thing they have to do is say, I'm sorry. And then they have to hug. Right? That's a rule. I'm not willing to get into it until they've hugged each other, because when you hug someone, you can't really be that mad at them. Why is that? Because when I hug someone, I'm giving them a little bit of myself. And when you give to someone, you love them. So if there's someone in this world that you want to love, love them. And you'll love them. Now I'm thinking, like, if somebody would walk out or just turn on, you know, whatever, this tape, and Benny Friedman's Profound Insights. If you want to love someone, love them. Okay, that's good. But I want you to understand. I want you to understand how deep that is. And how many people miss that because it's so obvious. You know, I remember when I got out of the army. So I had a little bit of a chip on my shoulder. You know, you finish the army 4.5 years, you start getting the chance to see some of your old friends again, they're finished college. You know, you've been, you know, majoring in artillery 101, right? And I especially remember I had a tough time, you know, with my folks for a while. Because I couldn't handle the goodbyes. They would come, they would visit, they would go. So I realized, like, I wasn't happy with the way my relationship was going with, you know, with my folks. So I decided to start doing things for them. If you have a hard time with your parents and you want to have a healthy relationship with them, just do things for them. You should do that anyway, because at least, you know, unless you're... I'm not saying it can't be that a relationship is in a stage where you need to be away from each other. It's a different story. But in a normal parameter, so if you do things for them, you'll fall in love with them all over again. And the more you do things for someone, the more they eventually want to do things for you. So if you do things for someone constantly and they start to do things for you, which is the difference between turning yourself into a dish rag and being part of a relationship, then you'll be in love. It's very simple. So if you wake up one morning and you're not in love with someone, it's because you're not doing anything to build that love. Because love is not a noun, it's a verb, and you have to work at it. And if you spend 3 years and you ask yourself, when was the last time you did anything romantic for the partner in your life, and you can't think of it, and you ask yourself, when was the last time you said I love you, and you can't think of that, and you ask yourself, when, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So of course you're not going to be in love. Because love isn't something that, you know, you just put it in the bank account and it grows. You have to work at it. It's a lot of hard work. So the first stage is, can I know? Can I begin the process of developing a relationship? And the second stage is, how do I build that relationship? How do I make that relationship last? And that's by giving. That's by doing. That's by working. That's why, by the way, the most important aspect of a healthy relationship, when you look for the right partner in your life, you stop to think about it, is, are we prepared to get to work? Do you find someone who shares the same goals, and are they willing to put the work in that you are? Because if you're both willing to work at it, then you'll be in love. And if you're in love, whatever love noun means, but you don't work at it, you won't stay there anyway. Because you didn't do anything to earn it in the first place. In fact, and that's a whole other discussion, the fact that people are waiting to be in love is probably one of the reasons why so many people never find love. Because that's not the way love works. And by the way, it's very interesting. If you look at the beginning of Judaism, there is a fundamental difference between the relationship God has with Noah and the relationship God has with Abraham, with Abraham. When the Torah speaks of Noah, it says, right, Et Elohim hitalech Noah, and Noah walked before God. When the Torah speaks of Abraham, God says to Abraham, hitalech lefanai v'yetamim, walk before me. You be in front of me. Abraham is the first partner in the Torah who is actually proactive with God. He does not rely on the relationship he discovers. He works at it. He builds it. And that's why it lasts. So that's the second stage. Now that leads to an interesting question. This is all very nice. Can I build a relationship? Can I know that God exists? Can I know the person that I'm with is the person I want to be with? Do I have to have that? Do I need to have that? So I will tell you in a nutshell that Judaism actually suggests that you don't. Does God in the Jerusalem Talmud? It is absolutely meaningless. And what are those mitzvot? And this is a stage that we'll get to down the road, because this is where this series is going. So what are all these mitzvot? One of the discussions we're going to have, I don't know, Gili has the list, but in 2 weeks or 3 weeks, which is, you know, what is all this ritual? It's all great, you know, we want to be good people. Isn't it enough to be a good person? What, I need Judaism to be a good person? What is all that? How does being a good person have anything to do with whether I eat this, that, or the other? Mitzvot basically are those pieces of work that I put into my relationship with God. And they are the vehicle for developing that relationship, without getting too much into the details. And it's interesting, by the way, that if I am actually not obligated to believe, it's an interesting question. The Rambam Maimonides in the first mitzvah of the book of mitzvot says, mitzvah gedolah ad ma'od leidash yesham aloha, there's a mitzvah to know that God exists. It's an interesting question what that means. And again, I assume that knowledge is a goal. But knowledge is also a verb. In fact, the first time I find the concept of knowledge vis-a-vis a person, in other words, in terms of what a person does, is Vayeda Adam et Chava Ishto, and Adam knew Eve, verb. And of course, you know, when you're in third grade and it says, and Adam knew Eve, you know, in a biblical sense, what that means is that Adam developed a relationship with Eve. Knowledge is about relationship, right? So there's a mitzvah to relate to God. But it's not a mitzvah to get there. It's a mitzvah to be on the journey. And that's very much about what I do, and very not much about what I think. So it's an interesting point. And it raises another question, by the way, which is, how does this affect me in my life vis-a-vis choice? You know, what does it mean to be Jewish? What is Judaism about? Do I choose to be Jewish? Or did Judaism choose me? And I want you to know that's another interesting discussion that we're going to have, God willing. What does it mean to be a Jew? Is it an accident of birth? And there are two stages. One is that I am chosen to be Jewish. I could be chosen to be Buddhist. I could be chosen to be Catholic. I have to be chosen to be Jewish, whatever that means. And what does chosenness mean? That's also a challenging concept. I think that's actually next week. But do I actually then proactively choose to live Jewishly? Interesting question, without even defining what that means. And how do I define choice? And that leads me back to the second part of my first question. There's a Talmudic discussion in the Tractate of Pesachim, on the 50th folio. Such an important concept. It says, Mitoch shelo lishma, ba lishma. If I do something not for lishma, for its sake, an interesting question what its sake means, eventually I'll end up doing for its sake. In other words, if I do a mitzvah, but I don't do it for the purpose of God or for the higher purpose or for the purpose of the mitzvah, whatever lishma for its own sake means, I'm doing it for some ulterior motive. By virtue of the fact that I'm doing it, I will end up doing it for the right reason. Now understand that this is a very important idea, and we'll get back to this, God willing. But it's an interesting question. What is its sake? What is its goal? What is the goal that I'm not doing it for that I would want to do it for? What is the goal of all of this? Is the goal God? Is the goal me? Is the goal the world? Very difficult question. And I want to understand this. What is our need for that goal? So just to paraphrase, so we know where we're at. If the question is, how do I develop my relationship with God? How do I hang on to and consistently find that feeling with God? It forces me to ask the question, why do I have the goal to have a relationship with God in the first place? Like, let's say you don't have a relationship with God. But you're a good person. Agree with me, by the way, the fact that you have a relationship with God doesn't guarantee that you're going to be a good person. That's another discussion we're going to have, I think, in 6 weeks. You're seeing how this all fits together. Isn't this cruel? I love it. How is it that people do have such a relationship with God and do such terrible things? Something we once began to speak about but never really finished. But if my question is, how do I hang on to that relationship with God? What do I need it for? So let's say I don't have that relationship with God. So I want to tell you something very interesting. And I want you to know that this is a thought in progress. I can't tell you that I've gotten there yet. So I'm just sort of opening up and sharing you with this particular challenging idea. Where we go with this, I don't know, come back to me in 5 years. I don't believe that the goal is to find God. And I'm going to explain this. I don't believe the goal is to find God. The goal really is to find me. God doesn't need me to find God. God's there already. He's not lost. The goal is to find me. Can I find out who I'm meant to be? But part of finding me is finding a Kadosh Baruch Hu, is finding that piece of God that's within me. And so really the goal is to find God, because in order to find me, I need to find the God within me. And it's by finding me that I'll really find God. If I'm a created being, and I have purpose in this world, then the way that I will ultimately discover a relationship with the person, the thing, the entity, Hashem, who gave me that purpose, is to discover who I am. So that's an interesting idea. And by the way, I want you to understand that this responds to a very difficult question, which is, how can it be that so much evil has been done in God's name? Right, so how do I know God? How do I develop a relationship with God? Why do I want to develop a relationship with God? What if I'm really looking to develop a relationship with myself? So listen to this idea. This is very interesting. Manuel Rachman, a professor, taught a number of different places, YU, Babylon University, wrote an interesting treatise called The Condition of Jewish Belief. He suggests an idea. I'm not sure it would be fair to say I disagree with the idea so much as I disagree with the way I understand his idea. I'm not so sure. Maybe he didn't mean it the way I understood it. But since enough people understand this idea, whether or not you attribute it to him, I've got a problem with this. He says, Judaism, and I'm quoting here, Judaism encourages doubt even as it enjoins faith. Okay? Judaism encourages doubt even as it enjoins faith. A Jew dare not live with absolute certainty. As I always thought that the point is to know that Hashem exists. Says Professor Rachman, no, you don't want to know Hashem exists. In fact, it's not healthy to know that Hashem exists, because certainty is the hallmark of the fanatic. Doubt, on the other hand, is good for the human soul, bringing with it humility. When I know things for sure, then I become fanatic. I become dogmatic. How many times has how much evil been done in the name of pure, unadulterated, non-compromising truth? So that if I know God exists, then I know everything with absolute certainty. And so it's better to be in doubt, because doubt brings with it a certain humility. Now that's a very challenging idea. I'm not sure whether I actually disagree with the idea, or whether I disagree with my interpretation of this idea, or whether it's semantics. But I will tell you, the idea that I cannot know something with absolute certainty is not only anathema to me, it goes against pretty much everything I believe in. On the other hand, he's got a good point. When people know things with absolute certainty, inevitably, everybody else who doesn't have that certainty must be, by definition, wrong. And that gets you into a lot of trouble. Now, some of us are blessed to know that everybody else who doesn't agree with us is wrong, but for those of you who aren't used to that concept, right, presents certain challenges. So how do you deal with this idea? How do you find the balance? Is doubt good? Is certainty dangerous? Is that true? What about the concept of Yadata et Hashem? That you can absolutely know that Hashem exists. And how does the definition that we came up with for knowledge respond to this issue? So I want to say something interesting. Here again, a thought in progress. You see, there are two different concepts here. We've mentioned before, Rav Dessler talks about this, that words are the blueprint for creation. That everything created in the world is to be found within the lines of the Torah. That if there's something that I can't find in the Torah, it signifies that it's an illusion. This is a longer discussion that we've had, so if you're curious, you can come with me afterwards. Rav Dessler talks about this. If I find that a word is nowhere to be found in the Torah, it means that it's an illusion. And the best example I can think of is that you do not find anywhere in the Torah the word to have. Even in modern Hebrew, the word for having is yesh li, yesh it is, li to me, right? But that's not the same as having. The English word have does not exist in Hebrew. Because having was not created by God. We created the concept of having. And the reason having was not created by God is because it's an illusion. You don't really have anything in this world. In fact, the only things that you really have in this world are the things you give away. Those are the things you really have. The things that you think you have, you don't really have. And everybody discovers this sooner or later. If you're lucky and you're blessed, you discover it sooner. The word safek, doubt, and therefore the word vadai, the word vadai, which means certainty, are not to be found anywhere in the Torah. These are two crucial words within the halachic stream. The Talmud is full of this concept. Safek to Rabbanan, a doubt concerning rabbinical law. Safek to Raita, a doubt concerning biblical law. Sfek sfeika, double doubt. Ein safek motzi midei vadai. If you're in doubt, you can't remove something from certainty. Whatever. You find these words all over the Talmud. You don't find them anywhere in the Torah. Because God didn't create doubt. We created doubt. God just created. Why would God create doubt? God had no doubt about what God created. Because God created it. So you know, we have doubt about what God created. And therefore the word vadai, certainty, is a ridiculous word. What do you mean I'm certain? I'm certain that you're right. You're either right or you're not right. Why do I have to be certain that you're right? In fact, we're so confused about the relationship between doubt and certainty that we interchange them without even knowing what we're talking about. I'm sure I put my keys there this morning, which really means I have no idea. Right? We don't know which way we're going. So the word vadai, the word certain, is an illusion. The word vadai, certain, does not exist anywhere in the Torah. It's an illusion. But the word ladat, to know, that very much exists in the Torah. That's all over the Torah. The yadata et Hashem, that's the goal, to know Hashem. So I don't understand. If I can know, how is it that I can't be certain? What's the difference between knowledge and certainty? Do you hear the question? This is an amazing question. I want you to understand, this is such an important question. This is the question that became paramount on September 11th for the rest of the world, that we've been struggling with for the last 100 years. How can a person become so certain that they know what truth is? I don't know if you heard the news today. They can take a machine gun, they can walk down a crowded street in Yerushalayim, and open up on human beings. Beyond my comprehension. Hashem should bless us all that it's forever beyond our comprehension. And it's a frightening thing. I've met people who don't want to have anything to do with religion in any shape or form because they're convinced that to become too involved in religion, to get too close to that truth, is a very dangerous thing. And you know what? They're right. It's a very challenging thing. So what is the difference ultimately between knowledge and certainty? Knowledge is good. I want to know. But somehow certainty is problematic. So, I want to tell you an idea. I can't tell you for sure that I'm convinced that this idea is correct. I'm still struggling with it. But I wonder, if maybe the object is the fundamental difference between knowledge and certainty. You see, the word vadai, the concept of certainty, refers to everything around me. But knowledge really begins with me. The only thing that I can really know in this world is me. And that's enough of a challenge. But by definition, I can't know or hope to know anything besides me. Right? What is knowledge? Knowledge really is about relationship. How do I know another person? I develop a relationship with them. What I'm really knowing, the aspect of the relationship that is that knowledge, is actually the part of the relationship that is me. In fact, It was precisely when I began to understand this that my marriage reached a whole different level. You know, you get married, and you think you know who you want to marry. That's why you marry. And then you're married, you think, wow, I know my wife. And then one day you realize, and I don't think this has to do with me and my wife, this is just a general realization that men have to come to in terms of women. One day you just realize that you will never understand her. You will never understand her, you can never understand her, it is impossible for a male to understand a female, it's impossible. And it was only when I understood that I could never understand my wife that I started to get to know her. Now that's very deep. And I don't mean that as a line. Because when you start to realize that this other person is such a totally other world, how can you possibly know an other world in totality? When you begin to discover the endlessness of this other person, and you begin to realize you can never really get to know them, that's when you begin to develop a relationship with them. And by the way, the same is true with Hashem. How do you develop a relationship with Hashem? If Hashem exists, and I certainly believe Hashem exists, if Hashem exists, the definition of Hashem is that Hashem is endless. And since we are finite beings in the end, so then we cannot possibly hope to ever fully understand or even come remotely close to understanding God. So if I can't understand Hashem, how can I have a relationship with Hashem? Because it's precisely when I realize that I can never understand Hashem that I begin to develop a relationship with Hashem. Okay, so that's a great line, and I'm looking at people like, great, what the heck is he talking about? So I'll give you an example. Because this is a very important idea. I'll give you an example. We won't discuss it now, but, you know, in a few short minutes when we finish, if you're curious about this, I'll be glad to take questions. There's a famous theological question. Nothing to do with Judaism. Any theological undertaking to explore God as an endless being, and I don't really understand the concept of God that isn't an endless being, has to struggle with this question. And there are different affectations of this question. The most famous is, can God create a rock that he can't lift? Right? Everybody's heard this question. Can God create a rock that God cannot lift? So on the one hand, if God can't create a rock that God can't lift, then how great is God? And I can create a rock that I can't lift. And if God can create a rock that he can't lift, so how great is God? There's a rock he can't lift. And so, you know, brilliant philosophers thought up this question, and they're sitting there in their chair saying, oh, right? This is great. So there's a German philosopher, you know, whose name eludes me, but in the early 60s, he came up with a brilliant response to this. He said, well, of course God can create a rock that God cannot lift, because God can do anything. And then when God creates this rock that he can't lift, well, then he can lift it, because God is unlimited. So you look at this question and you say, oh, that's ridiculous. And of course, that's the whole point. Because you're putting God with this question into a box. But God doesn't live in that box. You're asking a question based on your limited logical, my limited logical understanding. But that's not how Hashem works. So what if there's a rock somewhere that can't be lifted and can be lifted at the same time? Now that was German philosophy's nice way of saying, idiot! You can't understand. How could you understand anything that could always be and always will be? How could you understand that which comes before everything? And so some people think that because I can't understand, then I can never develop a relationship, but that's not true. It's precisely when I begin to understand that I can never fully understand that I develop a relationship. This is true with all things. The things that I think I can fully understand, I will never fully develop a relationship with. The things that I begin to realize I can never fully understand, that's when my relationship can become unlimited. It's true with my children. You know, little Yair, right? So, we're sitting at the Shabbos table, and Yair decides that it's hot. Now, if you're a three-year-old and it's hot, what do? You take off all your clothes. So, little Yair comes out in all of his glory, right? But, the kids were playing and he wanted to be Superman. So he put on a Superman cape. And he comes running out, jumps up on the sofa, ta-da! I'm Superman! In all of his glory. And there are certain aspects of Yair that you can never understand. And never will. And that's when you begin to develop a relationship. So understand this idea, right? That knowledge I can only have of myself. Certainty is what I want to have with everything else. I think maybe what Judaism is suggesting is that I have to recognize that I can't have certainty. Because certainty means that I can know about anyone else. And that's not so. Just because I discover truth in my relationship with Hashem doesn't mean that I can know where you're at in your relationship with Hashem. It doesn't mean that I can know that that truth works for you. It doesn't mean that I can tell you how you can find your relationship or how you can discover truth. So if I have the ability to develop an unlimited relationship with Hashem for myself, which really means that I can develop an unlimited relationship with myself, I have to recognize that I can't achieve that same level of relationship with anyone else, because they're not me. And therefore I can never reach absolute certainty with anyone else. And that's the mistake of those individuals who are created in the image of God and who forget what that image is all about. Who walk into a street corner with a machine gun and think that the knowledge that they've arrived at for themselves produces certainty regarding anybody else. That's exactly where it goes wrong. And I'll give you one last example, because I want you to understand how this works and this will end. There is one last question which this raises. If I know that Hashem exists, which allows me to begin to develop my relationship with Hashem. I ran into somebody this morning, not by chance, right? At Josh's place. You should go eat there. Big Mitzvah place is open 24 hours. Big Mitzvah to eat. Any Jewish place is open 24 hours. And it's just a personal theory. And I'm thinking of renting office space there at 2 in the morning. And oh, it's 101st Street in Broadway? Yeah. Right. We'll be there, right? And so I was having this discussion with somebody, sort of developing this, you know. I was actually sitting, it's funny, I was sitting on a plane this morning, and I was writing down the notes. In fact, I can even find the squiggle in the line where I was writing down the note, right? Is it here? Yes. I was writing down these notes, you know, and I was just trying to put this class into focus. And I was sort of trying to figure out what to do with this question. Like, I want to feel God. And so I'm writing down on this index card here, I want to feel God, right? And then we hit this major surge of turbulence. And this woman was sitting next to me on the plane, right? And she's like noticing what I'm writing. I'm writing, I want to feel God. And then, boom, she looks at me. She says, you want to be careful what you write there, you know? But so I'm having this discussion with somebody today, and you know, so he reminded me that this part of this is actually to be found. It's an amazing book. It was written by Joseph Telushkin and Dennis Prager, I think, in the 70s. It used to be called The 8 Questions People Ask About Judaism, and then they wrote it as 9 Questions. I think personally it's up to about 19, but okay. And he makes a point there, which I did not take the time to look up, so I'm quoting from memory, but someone will do me the service and see if I'm right. But I'm pretty sure that he writes there that one of the challenges with this idea is that if I know that God exists, right? So then that limits my choice. In other words, if I knew for sure that God was sitting here, then I wouldn't be able to choose to do evil. And therefore my good would have no value. And therefore Judaism suggests I can never know that God exists, because if I knew God exists, that would limit my choice. And I have a real problem with that. And again, I'm not sure if what I have a problem with is what he really meant, so I'm just using that as a launching pad. But clearly the Torah does not say that. And the Torah gives us many, many instances where characters in the Bible know with absolute certainty that Hashem exists and nonetheless can completely ignore Him. Whether it's the more obvious, for example, the Jewish people standing at the Red Sea, Kriyat Yamsuf, and they know Hashem exists because they've just come out of 10 plagues, and they see the Egyptians coming, and they see the sea before them, and they're terrified. How can they be terrified? They know Hashem exists. They know Hashem. They know it's all going to work out. But I'll give you an even better example, because it allows us to focus on this more humanly, where this will end. And also because we spend a lot of time, because of the weekly portion, studying Torah, and we don't get enough to the Navi. We don't get enough to the prophets. Stories in the prophets are just incredible. And it breaks my heart how these stories have so much to speak to us about, and we just never study them. And by the way, just as an aside, if you choose, as a result of the next 3 minutes, to explore these stories, there are a number of different ways to do it in English. There's a set of volumes in Judaica Press, and the Art School has it, and it's really worth doing. But anyway, one of the stories that's most known is the story of David and Goliath. David and Goliath. Now, did you ever stop to think about this? If you look in Shmuel, in the first book of Samuel, Shmuel, in the 17th Perek Yudzayin, right? Vayishma Shaul v'chol Yisrael et divrei ha'plishti ha'ele. They hear the words of this Philistine. He's booming out in the valley. Whoever will come down, your man should fight me. And whoever wins, and if I win, your people will be sold into slavery. Vayishma Shaul v'chol Yisrael, and Saul and the whole people of Israel hear the words of this Philistine. Vayechatu, vayir'u ma'od. And they were trembling, and full of fear. And it's a very difficult thing to understand. What were the Jewish people so scared of? Mi chamocha ba'elim Hashem? Who is like unto you, God? I'm afraid of a 9-foot megalo giant when 200 years ago I was taken out of Egypt? The whole book of Judges is one miracle after another. And Saul is afraid. King Shaul and his son Yonatan, where is Yonatan? And what's amazing, by the way, is that Yonatan, if you look at the story of Yonatan, I have an affinity for that story because we named our son Yonatan. There's an amazing story, which you should look up. It's in the 14th chapter. I actually once got away with presenting this to a group of army officers as part of my training, as a military exercise. The Philistines encamp in a place called Michmash, which is in the hills of outside Yerushalayim, in the tribe of in the hills in the high land of Binyamin. And Shmuel comes up from the Gilgal, which is in today's Jordan Valley. And this entire Philistine encampment is opposite the Jewish people, and they're prepared to go to war. So Vayehi, 14th chapter of Shmuel Aleph of the first book of Samuel, Vayehi Ayom, and day breaks. Vayomer Yonatan, so Yonatan says, Lechavena Abraal Matzav HaPlishtim. Let's go to this Philistine position. Let's go do some recon. It's an intelligence mission. Ve'am lo yadaki alach Yonatan, and the people don't know Yonatan went. He didn't want to get permission because they tell him he was nuts and you can't do this and we have to explore and there's a big army. And it describes uvena ma'abarot, ma'abarot is when there's a nachal, when there's a stream, a creek bed, so there are sort of impassable low hills on either side of the stream. You can see it by the Jordan River. And he's sort of winding his way through these low hills. Shena sela me'aver mizeh, and there's a cliff wall on one side, v'shena sela me'aver mizeh, and a cliff on the other. Hashena echad mitzuk mitzafon, there's a northern cliff and a southern cliff, and he's sort of working his way in the middle. V'na'abral matzavar elim, and let's go to the position of these uncircumcised Philistines. Ulai aseh Hashem lanu, maybe Hashem will do for us a great thing. And eventually he finds the Philistines, v'tehi amakah, and they attack the Philistines, him and his armor bearer, the two of them. V'tehi amakah rishonah sherikah Yonatan v'roseh kilav ki'asrim nishin, so he wipes out 20 Philistines. So that sounds like, that's not so impressive, right? We're waiting for big miracles, hundreds of thousands. Do you know what it is for two guys to take out 20 soldiers? That's a serious thing. They didn't have artillery back then. He did it with his hands. This is Yonatan. Takes out 20 Philistines. Wins the entire battle of the day. And three chapters later, all of them are trembling in their boots at Goliath. It makes no sense. It has to be that there's something missing. So the Gemara, the Talmud in Sota, has an amazing comment. The Gemara says that there's a verse there, which is very interesting. There's a verse in Dvarim, in Deuteronomy, which I happen to remember because I used to say this all the time. And it says, right? This is Ki Tetzel L'Milchama, when you will go out to war. It's actually in the 20th chapter of Dvarim, of Deuteronomy. So it says, V'yakakor V'chem L'Milchama, when you will come close to the battle. V'nigasha Kohen V'diber L'am. The Kohen will come and speak to the people. It's interesting. Back then, the Kohen, the rabbinate, they went to the front lines. They weren't back in their offices in Jerusalem. They were with the men on the front. V'amar Elihem Shema Yisrael, listen, O Israel. Sound familiar? Atem krevim hayom l'milchama l'oivechem. You are close to the battle. Al yerach levavchem. Let not your hearts be soft, weak. Al tiru, don't fear. Ki Hashem Elohechem. This is a verse that we say to this day in the special prayer that we say for the soldiers of Israel, of the IDF. And it's a prayer that soldiers actually say. It's a special prayer that the army rabbinate after 1948 came out with. This is part of a prayer of a tefillah that you say when you go into battle. Ki Hashem Elohechem ha'olech imachem, because God goes with you into battle, lilachem lachem, to do battle for you, im oyvechem, with your enemies, lo'oshia etchem, to save you. Don't be afraid, because you're not going into battle on your own, you go with God. So they're afraid. So the Gemara in Sota, the Talmud says an amazing thing. It's a Gemara on the 42nd folio, Mem Bet Amud Aleph, says, what does it mean that the Kohen says Shema Yisrael? If you will even say the Shema in the morning and the evening, that mitzvah alone will have enough merit that you will survive and be victorious in battle. So the Talmud goes on and says, and how do we know this is true? Because there's a verse by this same story of Goliath, right? Vayigasha Plishti, the Plishti, the Philistine Goliath. When would he go out and scream and yell and taunt the Jews? Hashkem v'harev, early in the morning and in the evening.
And so the Talmud says what he was doing was preventing the Jews from being able to say the Shema. And because they couldn't say the Shema, therefore they couldn't be victorious in battle, therefore they were afraid. So what then? What is that? Like, hey, don't let them say the Shema, because then woo. So I'm not saying that that's not true, and you can imagine that when I was in Lebanon, we said the Shema with all sorts of different levels of intent. But I think it's really meant to be allegorical. There's something about the recipe for Shema that is my ability to know, my ability to be strong, my ability to have faith. That's what the Shema is. You see, the challenge in my relationship with God is not just knowing that God is there. It's making a conscious decision to bring God into my life every single day. That's what it means. In fact, the reason it says Shema, listen, hear that God is there, as opposed to seeing. Because when you hear something, sound, unlike sight, is much less a decision of choice. I can choose to look this way, or I can choose to look that way. But sound is everywhere. I just have to let it in. I just have to open my ears to hear what's already there. So hear, O Israel, Shema Yisrael, is let it in. Now, how do you let it in? How do you make that a part of your life every day? Well, so what's the first chapter of the Shema? V'ahavta. Ahava, love. Not v'ahavta, and you'll find love. Not love the noun, how come I didn't find love. V'ahavta, love the verb. Love God. So what does it mean, love God? How could you not love Hashem? If I know Hashem exists, of course I love Hashem. Hashem gives me anything. No. It's a lot of work to love Hashem. And I have to make a decision to put that work in every day. How do I have the relationship that I'm looking for with my children, with my wife, with my work, with the people I work with the people I meet, with all of you, with everything that comes into my life every day, with all that comes into your life every day? It's a conscious decision every day to let it in. Ve'ahavta. To practice the constant, uninterrupted flow of Ahava. It's terrible that we translate that word as love, because it does no justice to what that word really means. That's the secret. That's exactly what's going on, and it's very interesting. We take our name. What do we call ourselves? We call ourselves the people Yisrael. What does it mean, Yisrael? Ki saritaim Elokim batuchal. Yaakov has this lonely battle in the night with the angel, whatever that is. And in the end, he's called Yisrael because you have struggled with God and you have overcome. We are meant to struggle. We're meant to struggle. Not to struggle with knowledge. To struggle to hang on to that. To struggle to make sure that that relationship is everything that it can be every single day. And when we fail, we get up the next day and we start all over again. What does it mean, Vayivater Yaakov Levado, and Yaakov was left alone? The Ishbitzer says an amazing thing. He says, Yaakov was struggling with the question, am I really alone? That's the struggle. And I am only alone if I let myself be alone. If I choose to never be alone, then that's where I'll be at. And so that's the first stage. To know, to love, to understand that love is a verb in all the relationships that I have, and to make a conscious decision to consistently turn that knowledge into meaningful relationship by giving. And I want you to know something. This is all very cute. We came, we sat, we niggonized, maybe a couple questions, some more niggonizing. But I want you to know, if you don't take this idea and put it into practice in whatever way you choose to, then this whole evening was a waste of time. That's the real challenge. If one person in this room recognizes tomorrow, tonight, that you can take this idea and you can actually activate love in your life, with all the people that you want your love to grow with and for, that's what Torah is about. That's the difference between an intellectual exploration and a spiritual experience. Lila Tov, thank you for coming.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972 972- 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.